Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. We're back in Dingle this week for another from our Other Voices series recorded last month. Una Mullally joined us by the firing Foxy Johns for a conversation about her work as a journalist and activist. This covered everything from the early days as a freelance music writer and her days as a Sunday Tribune to her current role at the Irish Times and her review of 2015's marriage referendum. It was a great, meaty, fierce, funny and often emotional conversation. Right now, we are joined by a writer, an activist, an author, a broadcaster, a feminist, a Dublin football fan, a Man United fan, sadly, and much, much more. Would you please welcome the legendary Una Mullally? So what did I leave out?
Thirsty.
There's a drink on its way to you. There's a drink. Okay, let's start by being really reductionist. Why did you become a journalist in the first place?
I actually wanted to be a lawyer and had planned to do law at the change of mind form at the CAO, I just thought, no, journalism sounds a lot easier.
Journalism is the last refuge of the scoundrel.
Yeah, well, I suppose it is. And I changed the change of mind form, and then I had got thanks, Meter. I got a scholarship to do a master's, and one of the things that I could do was go to King's Inns and train to be a barrister. And at that stage, I'd gone into the Tribune on a work placement, and so I could defer it for a year. I deferred it for a year, and was like, okay, now I'll go back and do law, and then I just didn't.
Do you ever regret not doing law? Law's an interesting subject. Law's interesting. It's an interesting discipline.
No. I think it's one of the problems that I have with things is that I would like to be the thing, wouldn't like to put the work into it.
Okay, fair enough. Which is an ideal way to be a journalist. Ideal way to be a journalist then. Like, yeah. What were you like as a teenager? Were you stroppy? Did you ever give your uncle back the... Did you ever give your uncle back the book on Lenin you borrowed from him?
Wow, Jesus, where did you get that one out of?
No, hey, as I say in Me and Ireland, the Dying Girl, respect the research.
Respect the research. No, I didn't. I was quite stroppy as a teenager. I spent a good 3 or 4 years locked in my bedroom listening to Nirvana and Hole. I was quite the generic, you know, depressed, world of shit, I'm going to join the Socialist Workers' Party type teenager. But I was also very, extraordinarily nerdy as well, and very stressed about school and studying, and would have put myself under a lot of pressure.
How did you do in your exams?
In the Leaving Cert? Yeah. Grand, yeah, quite well.
Do you want me to pull out your Leaving Cert now?
We got them in the bag, babes. Go ahead.
did you write as a teenager?
I did write from when I was about 16. I met this guy who became a friend, and we started publishing zines, which we would sell in Tower Records and in Sound Cellar Records, and other Freebird and stuff like that. And one of the first zine was called Infotainment, which is the worst title for a magazine ever. And the second one was called QED. So they would have like Nine Inch Nails album reviews and, you know, essays on American imperialism, you know, the full spectrum. I did write as a teenager, yeah. And then when I was about 19, I wrote for The Slate shortly as well, or for a short while. And then I suppose when I was about 19, 20, I started working for the Event Guide.
Yeah, the Event Guide is a great, great training ground. It really was.
I mean, you worked there as well.
I worked there, yeah. But I worked like 20 years for you there because I'm an old fucker. But like it was great because they give you your head. They let you kind of go on. And I was looking back through the week at some of the old Clueless archives and kind of like seeing some of the stuff you're writing about there, you know. And like, you know, it was like there was a passion there, you know. You were passionate. It was black or white. There's no grey areas.
Yeah, I am very passionate about music specifically, and I guess at that time. It's funny, I didn't really ever read much music journalism as a teenager. I could never, like, I used to read Rock Sound and Melody Maker. I wasn't really big into the NME. And then I read Hot Press and stuff, but I wasn't like, I suppose, well, this stuff wasn't really accessible, you know? So then when blogs came along, that was really interesting to me, especially at a time where there was, you know, amazing, you know, North American indie music coming up. Yeah. And obviously that coincided with the dawn of kind of, you know, music journalism on blogs and you know, the first tool of a music blogger is that kind of passion or whatever. So when I was reading that kind of stuff about people like going mental for, you know, Death Cab for Cutie and stuff, yeah. You know, that was like, you know, that kind of, you know, made me think, okay, mate, you know, I really like this music and all I do is listen to music and all I do is go to gigs. So, you know, I can write about it as well, I guess.
I remember years ago at Soundcheck or something, we were talking about the Event Guide and you said basically that one of the things that you learned most about the Event Guide was just that the speed of writing, the speed of transcription, the speed of getting things around. Well, like, I mean, what other qualities did you take from that time? Because, I mean, it was a good school to go to because everything was thrown at you.
Yeah, I mean, what was great about the Event Guide, it was this free sheet that was around in Dublin for film and music. And was some theatre in it?
Maybe? There was some theatre in it, sadly, yeah.
But yeah, so I started working there because basically I was working in a music venue called The Hub, that is still called The Hub in Temple Bar, but it has gone through about three name changes before it's come back to where it started. And they had opened up and they had a website, and I went into the manager and said, if you have a website, I'll write the gig reviews for you if you let me go to the gigs for free. And he said, yes. So I did that and would stay there, be there like five nights a week. And then John Brereton, a music promoter and a writer as well, he was a musician, he was writing in the Event Guide and he was leaving, I think, and Kieran Owens, the editor of the Event Guide, needed one person who could just do all of the music writing, and John suggested me. And so the upshot of that was you would have to interview so many bands turn them around really quickly. It was basically every single band of note that was coming through Dublin, you had to interview for the gig previews. Yeah. So, you know, there were definitely days where I would be writing and turning around five or six interviews a day. Mm. And they would be, you know, 800, 1,000, 1,200 word interviews. So you could be writing like, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 words a day. And that's when it was just like, okay, you just have to lash it out. And I think when I went into the Tribune then, because I could just like write things really quickly, that's how I got work, you know.
Yeah. I mean, someone's interviews obviously stand out. Talk us about the Marky Smith interview.
You know, Jim, one of the things about me is that I have an absolute terrible memory. Like, I'm sure, he was a dick, though, I remember, yeah. Actually, that was a terrible interview. He was the rudest. That's why I like, you know, I like The Fall, but I think Marky Smith is an obnoxious person, you know, and I think it's the only people who get on with him and who really like him in terms of interviews are...
Obnoxious themselves.
Well, or just, like, in awe that somebody could be such a dickhead and he could get away with it because it's like, oh, I want to be a dickhead. I wish I could get away with being a dickhead. Yeah, Marky Smith is not a nice guy. You know, it's funny, just in terms of memory, someone mailed me the other week. It was some anniversary to do with Elliot Smith. And they were like, oh, you know, I'm just getting in touch because I remember like that time in, I don't know where it was, the Red Box or something.
Bone Factory.
No, it wasn't. It was in...
Jesus, God bless your memory.
It was in... I don't know where it was, but they're like, I had booked like three people to interview Elliot Smith and you were the only person who turned up and you guys got on really well and he was saying to me afterwards how he really liked you and I was just like, I interviewed Elliot Smith, the person. Like, I don't remember. Like,
yeah.
So, but there were so many, like hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah. So like, obviously then, like, let's move on to the Tribune because I mean, you were in the Tribune kind of like, you know, in the years when it was an amazing paper, like, you know, that you were there. I think Matt Cooper was still editor when you were there.
No, he wasn't. He'd just gone.
So Noreen was there.
Noreen
right?
had just come in.
So the Sunday Indo had that kind of like, I mean, like Oak Tree Gang.
Yeah, but, I mean, peak Celtic Tiger journalism, essentially, especially Sunday journalism, which really lent itself to the Celtic Tiger because everybody, you know, as a Sunday print journalist, you know, you have to come up with your own stories. Whereas, you know, I always think daily news reporters are blessed because they just report on the news that's happening or go to the markings or whatever. Obviously, as a Sunday print journalist, you have to generate your own copy. The Sindo at the time chose to do, like, just go, like, space cadet nuclear on, like, you know, just, like, let's just get, you know, loads of birds to write about, you know, going to Crystal or whatever. Whereas the Sunday Tribune, you know, had such a great, you know, I mean, Plus Échange and all that. But, like, I mean, the Sunday Tribune had a great, you know, a bunch of writers, and it really was a writer's paper. And, yeah. And because it was the underdog, because it was always, you know, I&M had it by the balls, and in the end, screwed it over.
Yeah.
And you know, the Tribune was always really just a spoiler for the Sunday Times. You know, it was just a paper that existed economically so that the Sunday Times couldn't get a stronghold in the market. So because you kind of, what's going on here? Oh, sorry. Because of that, it was you could kind of get away with an awful lot, I suppose. You know that for a sec.
Yeah, I mean, and like, you know, the writers you had there as well at the time were pretty amazing. I mean, yeah. You had amazing sports writers. Malky Clerk was there. Kieran Shannon was there. Like, there was yourself. Paul Howard was there. Olivia Doyle. You know, amazing. It was an amazing school of journalists.
It was, yeah, and for me, going in there just as I turned 22 and, you know, sitting opposite Dermot Doyle, who for me, although he doesn't write columns as much anymore, is, you know, one of the best columnists this country's ever produced. Justine McCarthy was there, Fiona Looney was there, Paul Howard. You know, this is how good the Tribune was in terms of writers. Ruan McCormack was a sub-editor, you know, who's one of the best journalists for me in the country. Paul Lynch was in production, who has written, you know, two of the great Irish novels of the past, whatever he is. Gav
Corbett
was also, you know, subbing and stuff. He's another amazing novelist. When the Tribune closed down, within 1 year, 11 books had been published by people who worked in the Tribune who hadn't published books previously.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the quality of writing in that paper was insane.
Yeah. Okay, so after Tribune closed down, I mean, like, the old lady of Tara Street came calling and you started, like, freelancing for the Irish Times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how long were you freelancing for the Irish Times before they decided, okay, we're going to get Mullally in on Monday and give her a column?
Memory again. I think somebody had gone on holidays and maybe it was I've been in there now 4.5 years, but I'm still freelance.
Yeah.
So I don't work in the office. I just go into the office for meetings. I think it was maybe 2 years in or a year and a half in. Someone went on holidays and they said, "Will you fill in for a Blaz column for 2 weeks?" And I said, "Yes." And then that 2 weeks turned into 4 weeks and turned into 6 weeks. And then I got a call from Kevin O'Sullivan one morning after a few months. It was a Sunday morning, actually. It was really early. And he just said, Kevin is the editor of the Irish Times, and he just said, "You know, we really like your column. We would like to keep it on for another 6 months. And I said, "Okay." And I haven't really had any communication, like, to suggest otherwise. So I've just been like, "Here you go." Still happening, right?
But it is still happening, and, like, I mean, it gives the paper a really interesting voice that it didn't have. You know, it really did. I mean, it's like, it's younger than an awful lot of the voices on the Opinionet page. It's, like, I mean, definitely an awful lot more alternative. You cover subjects from a different kind of angle. When you got the column, when you kind of realised you were going to keep on the column, did you kind of, like, say to yourself, hey, here we go, I can actually kind of, like, I mean, set agendas here? Or was it a case of, it was a way of kind of reacting to what was in the news, given your particular spin on things that no one else in the paper would share?
I think I was probably quite scared, to be honest, because I think it is kind of funny in some ways that I do have a column in the Irish Times. For whatever a column in the Irish Times means, you know. I see it as quite, you know, it is a position of privilege that I'm very grateful for. The Times, in terms of what's said in that paper, can still be quite powerful. It has the ability to dictate other media, or, you know, just general conversation, what people are talking about. So I suppose at the start I was quite like, "Hope I don't, you know, trying to, I hope I don't libel someone within 5 minutes or whatever, you know, that kind of being scared of that kind of thing, or just like getting the tone wrong. But I think,
I just want to kind of tease that out a little bit, you know, not the libel, but tease out the kind of thing about tone. I mean, like, you know, that there's a sense when you're writing for the Irish Times that you've graduated from kind of like junior hurling or intermediate hurling to senior hurling. And like, I mean, from intermediate football and junior football to senior football. I'm talking to a dub as well, sorry, football. Yeah. So basically, the tone is really important. You know, I mean, like, I remember when I started writing paper, it's like, you know, you'd write stuff online, straight away, up there, no hesitation. But when it came for the paper, your tone changed. How long did it take you to kind of like lose that break?
I think that there are certain things that I would write in the art section in a certain tone that I just simply couldn't write, you know, as a columnist. You know, you have to, there are certain things that I say in conversation or on my blog that I wouldn't be able to put in the column. Now, that's not, you know, checking myself or anything, but I mean, there are it is a specific style of you know, on the page, in the paper. My column is on current affairs mostly, or reacting to the events of the day or whatever. Occasionally I will pick out kind of quirkier stuff. But I mean, you can't be banging on with like Kendrick Lamar references or something like, and hoping that people will the Irish Times readership will get it. With all due respect to the Irish Times readership, but you know, you have to first of all, you have to come up with an idea and form an argument and articulate it really well to the standard and quality of that paper as I see it, and that's generally how I do it. You know, you do learn that there are certain things that people just respond to crazily, you know.
When you say respond, you talking like, mean people get in touch with you by email, people get in touch with you by Twitter, people and friends, or are you talking about the below the line thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's three things that as a columnist, certainly in the Irish Times, that if you write one about those three things, you know there's going to be a huge reaction. Those three things are abortion, violence against women, and restaurants. I'm deadly serious, like.
Okay.
Like, so they're the three things that really, you know, people go crazy about. But also,
I get the first two. I don't get why people why you necessarily
people
think.
People just love talking about restaurants. Like, people just love talking about restaurants, critiquing restaurants. Everybody thinks they're a food critic. Everybody thinks they know about food. People love slagging things that are perceived to be pretentious. People like to have the inner track on what's cool and where's a good place to eat. And that's just a fact. I've written one column on restaurants in 2.5 years. And like,
so do you hold the idea of writing a column on restaurants in reserve for that Sunday, horrible Sunday morning when basically you've got
no
idea?
No, not at all. No. I mean, I think how I work is I file about 3 or 4 ideas to the editor on a Thursday afternoon. He used to be a she, picks what the one that he thinks will work best, and I file it on Friday morning. Okay. And that's just how it goes. I like having prescriptive editors because I think that I need direction sometimes. And I think you become I wrote a column in the Sunday Tribune magazine for 2 years. I wrote a column at the Sunday Tribune paper for 2.5 years. I wrote a column in the Dubliner for a year. I've been doing this for 2.5 years. You know, it's easy in many ways.
This is the thing. It's like an awful lot of people who read the columns that opinion columnists write are kind of going, how can they have opinions on these things week in, week out? But it is easy.
It is, yeah, and I have a lot of opinions on a lot of things.
speaking of which, I mean, one thing that all good columnists do is they return to the same terrain before because they know there's meat left on the bone. Mm. I mean, like, aside from kind of abortion, violence against women and restaurants, I mean, are there other areas you've returned to where you know there's more meat to tackle? There's more there to niggle into and more to kind of move around?
Well, I think there's always something to be, I mean, I think there's always something to be said about the place that you live in. And, you know, what informs that and things that are right or wrong with that. And for me, I'll probably be talking a little bit more about Dublin than Ireland. And I suppose, you know, a lot of my writing has been informed by feminist thought and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I would look at gender equality a lot. But I would never, I never ever set out to write something that is controversial that will provoke reaction. The only thing that I write about are things that I think I've something to say about, or I've thought of something and I have an argument to form about it, or that I'm interested in. I don't see myself as like a provocateur or anything like that. Right. Although sometimes I write something, I'm like, yep, grand done, and then it gets this huge reaction. I would never have thought that.
But I mean, the other thing that's definitely changed in the last couple of years, and you've probably seen this more than anyone else given the column you write, is that like readers expect you to have take a side. You know, readers expect you to have a very strong opinion either way. And that's something that's brand new when it comes to the op-ed page as well, especially in the Irish Times.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of room for nuance in general in the world, and things aren't black and white. And I think comment facilities in particular lend themselves to being, you know, pits of things that are black and white. You know, everything is grey, life is complicated, there are loads of different perspectives and arguments to have on different sides. I think that there's a lot to be said for a columnist who appreciates nuance and doesn't necessarily have to be like, this is terrible. It's like, well, sometimes things are kind of terrible, but, you know, can also be kind of good. And I think that, you know, I would be one of the things that I struggle with a lot, existentially, I suppose, is kind of being worried about adding to that culture of constant opinion, constant argument, and just being another voice within what is becoming white noise. And that's something that I think all columnists struggle with. You know, oh, what a terrible problem to have, I suppose. But like, I mean, it's I find it, you know, I tend to shy away from the obvious topics and the obvious arguments. You know, if something happens during a week, like in pop culture, like, you know, at, you know, the MTV Awards, someone does something crazy, or there's some big argument on Liveline, or there's something everyone is talking about, I tend to not do those columns because I think that they're really obvious and everybody already knows the arguments. Like, I mean, columnists, you see that all the time, that the same topics over and over again, and because they're sometimes you're grasping for an idea for that week and you can't find it, so you just return to the obvious things. But like, do we really need more columns on whatever topic that everybody knows? Like, we know the arguments or whatever. So the difficulty for a columnist is to actually find something new to write about and find, notice something that is up and try and tease that out a little bit. That's a struggle.
Yeah. You mentioned there white noise. Have you any solutions in mind for solving the sewer pits that are below the line comments?
Get rid of them.
Perfect. That's the right answer. Yeah. Let's move on to a car. let's move on to a car journey from Kinsale to Dublin in September 2013. I was keeping to the speed limit all the way through. Yeah. It was a long journey, 4-hour journey. You told me about this book you were about to write called, you didn't have a name, so it's going to be, you signed a contract and it was very, you were ready to
start. No, I hadn't signed a contract.
You were about to, I told you to go and sign the contract.
Yeah.
So you basically, this was
just picture Thelma and Louise, but me and Jim. this set the scene.
Okay, so Thelma and Louise on the road from Kinsale to Dublin, and you're outlining this book. It's going to be an oral history of the marriage equality campaign, trying to get it done ahead of the referendum we knew was kind of coming at that stage.
Yeah.
When you took on the work, did you realise how much work was involved?
No. No, I did not, Jim.
Okay,
were you persuaded by... Well, I had done one version of a plan, which was kind of like a cross between, you know, Carrie and Homeland and all of her post-its and, like, The Wire, you know, corkboard with, like, you know, all the kind of stuff. And then I was just like... Because I love oral histories and I particularly love, which I know you like as well, Mark Yarm's Everybody Loves Our Town, which is an oral history on grunge. And it's just for the, what I particularly like about it, not just the subject matter and the people they interview, the structure of this book is amazing. There are so many people interviewed it, and the way the author just weaves everything around and positions everything is just brilliant. So I was looking at that and I was like, that structure is so amazing. Wouldn't it be, you know, it would be really interesting to apply that structure to this idea of doing an oral history on the movement for marriage equality in Ireland. Meninia Griffith, the then co-director of Marriage Equality, the organisation, had asked me to write some kind of an oral history and for them. And I said, no, I wouldn't do it. If I was going to do anything, it would just be independent.
Yeah.
So I started doing that. And then a publisher came to me and said, do you want to make it as... the History Press said, do you want to make it as book? And I said, yes. And then, you know, the real... trouble started, because it's so hard to write an oral history. Like, it is so difficult because there is such a mountain of work involved. What's good about them is that they're very democratic. And what I like about oral histories is that you oftentimes have conflicting accounts of memory, like right next to each other and from different people. And so the reader can then deduce what the truth is, as opposed to writing a book saying this happened and then this happened. But unfortunately, they're hugely work heavy. And so I interviewed, it took, I suppose, from conception to completion, it took 2 years. There was really like 6 months of really, really hard work, like full, totally, pretty much kind of, and a few months of like crazy full time. Yeah. But I interviewed about 100 people, over 100 people, and just weaved the history of the movement from marriage equality when it became an idea to before the referendum. So what, like, there's most of it is set over like 15 years, I would say. There's some background from the 70s and 80s, and so all the politicians who were involved in the legislative work, all the lobbyists, all the protesters, all whatever. It's really hard. I mean, I suppose I had about, like, let me just have a think about in terms of word count. The word count was like 100,000 words, basic. I think I filed 220,000 words, and I'd probably peeled that down from, like, it was definitely over, like, 500,000, 700,000.
Okay, so it's War and Peace territory.
Yeah, it's like, it's long. I mean, if you think, but if you think transcribing one 3 hour interview is a nightmare, like, try doing that 100 times.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In a short period of time, about the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm curious about some of the people who kind of contributed and the interviewees you had. You know, I mean, a lot of the politicians were involved in legislation. I mean, some of the things you were talking to Dermot Ahern, for example. Mm. You know, did you find the politicians keen to kind of like put stuff on the records, keen to kind of like buff their record in any way?
Some were and some weren't. Like, Dermot Ahern, I found fascinating because he hadn't actually given an interview since he left government, and he's such a clever guy, and I think was quite keen to tell what had happened in his way. So, you know, Dermot Ahern essentially, you know, was the Minister for Justice who brought in civil partnership. You know, would be the most unlikely person to do that. He's quite a very conservative guy. But I think because there is still a lot of bad blood between Fianna Fáil and the Green Party over civil partnership, and how the Green Party want to claim that this was the one good thing they did in government, and Fianna Fáil were saying, oh, they like to say that, but it was actually us, you know. And so there was a lot of that kind of political to-ing and fro-ing was really interesting to me, like how those arguments actually happened and how Dermot Ahern, you know, he says he basically pushed it through and you know, crossed fingers when it came to the Supreme Court not having a say, or the president saying, no, this is unconstitutional, or whatever, we're signing it over. So, you know, Dermot was very interesting. And he's, you know, he's a very, he's a nice guy, you know.
Nice guy, yeah. Years ago, when Peter Hook wrote a book about the Hacienda, one of the ways he promoted the book was very interesting. He published the legal report that his publishers had produced for the book. Would you ever publish the legal report you got for the book?
No.
Okay. In terms of, it took a while.
Like, there were, obviously, like, within the... I was finishing the book as Pantygate was happening. And that was obviously a legal minefield, remains so for some people. So that was very difficult. I mean, the book was delayed because there were so many voices. There's a lot of conflict in the book. You know, one politician says one thing, one person says another, one activist says one thing says another. So it needed a lot of, legal stuff. Most of it got in, though, but it was delayed. Publication was delayed because of that kind of the legal stuff, and that's very frustrating. I mean, you know, journalists fight with lawyers all the time, and you know, print and be damned is all well enough, but it's kind of different when a newspaper disappears after a day, a book, you know, stays on the shelf. So we had to get everything right, and we did, thankfully.
Okay, but of course, like, I mean, if you actually went to King's Inn in the first place when you were 18,
I know, right?
This would happen. So, I mean, the book was published last Christmas, and that led into...
This time last year, yeah.
Yeah, this time last year. So that led into then the run-up to the marriage referendum in May. And, like, you got heavily involved with that referendum.
Correct, yeah.
And, like, I mean, was that always going to be on the cards? I mean, you know, like, and was it the book that kind of pushed it in, or was it just the fact that, like, I mean, you're a very high profile person, you'd, like, very, very strong views, you're very articulate. I mean, was these the reasons why you kind of, like, I suppose, took such a part in the campaign?
Well, I'm gay as well.
Well, that goes without fucking saying, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Vested interest 101.
Oh shit, I forgot at the very start to kind of say you were gay, didn't it?
Yeah, you did. Oh, that was the other thing. The other little pigeonhole you missed.
Yeah. Fuck you, Malali.
Yeah, no, fuck you back, Jim.
tell Ma.
The referendum, I suppose, like a lot of, you know, people in the LGBT community have been involved at a grassroots level, just like protesting and stuff. Occasionally would write about it, but not a lot, really, I suppose. The referendum was when it was going to be on the horizon for 2015. Everybody, you know, became mobilised more so. And I always knew that, there aren't many gay print journalists, you know, and it is a very male, heterosexual space. And there, you know, I suppose as a columnist as well, I do have a platform, and I was always going to use that platform for my team, you know. And when the referendum was coming around, I knew that was going to be not just a big moment for me personally, but a big moment for me professionally, because I knew I had to get everything right. I had to get all of my arguments right. I knew I was going to end up, you know, doing debates and stuff and TV and radio. That all had to be right. And I wanted to be, you know, as good as I could be to represent my people, you know, my friends, my partner, my, you know, my exes, my, like, everybody that I knew, you know, all these, like, LGBT people that I knew. It's like, you know, when you're their person in some small way, you want to get everything right. And if, you know, if there is, like, a dyke writing for the Irish Times, well, she better fucking get her shit together, you know? And so that's what I tried to do. And we won!
So,
of course, in the interim time,
like, I mean, the dyke from the Irish Times, self-proclaimed, got in some
that
serious
is our
shit.
Word, Jim.
Sorry. Inverted comma, dyke from the Irish Times. Close inverted commas. got involved in some heated shit. You know, you got, like, I mean, you got down and dirty, so to speak, with like Breed O'Brien, with, like, I mean, the various. Representatives, the Red Commons from the Ionian Institute,
yeah,
and the other kind of, like, I mean, anti-campaigners. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that takes a toll.
Yes, it certainly did. What happened was basically, you know, I was always going to, like, for example, I always knew that I was going to have to write a really personal column during the referendum to, you know, pull at the heartstrings and win the hearts and minds. I don't write about myself in my columns. I'm not, you know, some people do it extraordinarily successful, like Roisin Ingle, who's like a friend and a mentor, an amazing writer. That's not what I do. But I knew that at some point during the referendum, I was going to have to go pull out the personal and expose myself and be like, if you're going to do it for anyone, do it for people like me. Of course, in the interim period, in March, on Friday the 13th, I was diagnosed with stage 3 bowel cancer. And so that personal element became very different for me. And the column I ended up writing ended up being one about, you know, my illness and how I, you know, felt this kind of nervousness about saying my partner was my next of kin in the hospital at the time. And so the referendum for me, you know, the whole campaign became this crazy thing of that I was sitting around thinking, well, this is, you know, the most important thing that has ever happened in my life in terms of the referendum, the campaign. All my friends were all canvassing and we're all doing everything. But I'm going through, you know, the biggest crisis that I've ever faced. And, you know, I remember the day I got diagnosed, starting canvassing quite shortly after that, because it was a week between I was diagnosed and got my stagings. And that interim week, the doctors didn't know if it was terminal or not. And so I was kind of started going at canvassing straight away, which was quite early in March, because I just thought I better start now because, you know, there's a chance that I mightn't be here in a few months. And so that was my kind of, that was where my head was at. And so when you put that kind of thing into context of something that is already extraordinarily stressful, you know, it was a rough time. Like,
yeah, I mean, but like, so some of the appearances, you know, I mean, they really, I remember there's one in particular on Late Late Show where you were with Colm McGorman, and that struck a chord with a lot of people, because, I mean, you know, like, just in terms of the arguments that were being made, the connections that were being made, you know, and at that stage as well, like, you know, you could see the change that was going on, you could see the change in the narrative, and you could see the change in the country as well, in terms of the acceptance of what was, of how the referendum was going to run.
Yeah, and I think that the precursor to the referendum being, you know, the conversation that Panty started about homophobia was really vital as well. And although very stressful for Rory personally and his family and friends, it did lay this groundwork of this conversation. It all of a sudden cracked out wide open. The Late Late Show thing, I suppose, you know, during any referendum campaign, there's always that big Late Late Show debate where people make the arguments and, you know, the Irish people kind of go, you know, it's that touchstone for referenda, you know. Being in that situation where you're going to be one of those people on that late show debate is a bit mad, and it was very daunting.
Was there much prep done for that?
There was, yeah. I mean, that particular week I was actually quite sick, so I was, you know, I was on chemo, like 24-hour chemo. So you wear this infusion thing, and you just like take it in all the time. And I was having radiation every day as well, and so. As it happened, the week after that, I had to be taken off chemo for a week because I got this bad reaction to it, this thing called colitis. So I was feeling really shitty that week. And the day of, actually, the evening of, in Ortí, myself and Colm McGorman, who were the representatives from the Yes side, had met up during the week and discussed how we would play it, basically. And, you know, myself and Colm got very close during the referendum. And so I trusted him absolutely. You know, I was just so happy that he was going, and Ortí had called who was going to be people or whatever. So I trusted Colm completely. You know, he's such an articulate speaker. He knows the terrain. He's been on the Late Late Show a bunch, and he just like hits the points, and he's just an amazing guy. I was lucky in that I'd been on the Late Late Show a couple of times already as well. So it wasn't like that daunting to me in terms of the setting. I think the day of, we then had a meeting with the Yes Equality guys and talked through what we were going to say, and they were like, yeah, that sounds good. You know, they didn't give us direction or anything. We kind of knew what we were going to do. And then when we got in there, it was just about like keeping zen and...
I mean, it must be like I'm curious about that thing, that keeping zen and keeping your emotions at bay in that situation. Given all those happened to you personally, I mean, it's like, it's almost like, you know, well, most people just take a load of drugs to kind of get through something like that, you know?
Well, previously, I was on a load of drugs.
Yeah,
I was
like, thinking, yeah. You know, like, I'm not the first or last person to go on a Late Late Show with a lot of drugs.
Correct, yeah. But no, I mean, I you know, it was, yeah, it was a crazy evening. I had brought in Sarah, my girlfriend, and my mum with me for moral support. And the two no campaigners, Keith Mills and Petra Conroy, were, you know, hanging around. But part of me felt a little, I knew that we were going to be better than them because I had yet to hear an argument from the no side that I thought was a good argument. And I thought our arguments were good. And also myself and Colm, knew the terrain. And no matter what anyone says, when you're sitting about to go on to the Late Late Show, even if you've done loads of like Claire Burns and Prime Times and all that kind of stuff, it's a daunting setting, you know. And I think myself and Colm were lucky that we had, you know, already been in those chairs and stuff. I felt very, very ill. So I think I was just trying to, like, not vom on Ryan Tuberty, for starters. And then it was just about, like, I just need to get through this. I mean, I will say that, like, I've never, ever felt under so much pressure in my life. I never felt as tense because I just thought, you know, you can screw up, you know, the last word or, you know, whatever. But, you can't screw up the late late. And I just thought that there was a lot riding on it. And I was happy with how he did, you know. And when I came out of that room, went into the green room, and I kind of almost collapsed. Like, I burst into tears, just because I felt so much pressure and there was so much riding on it, and everything that I was going through was like so crazy and still is so crazy. And I just thought, you know, it's tough enough to go on the Late Late Show and debate marriage equality during a referendum campaign, but when I was doing it, when I was quite sick, it was difficult.
Mm. I mean, as an upshot of that activism and the activism of thousands of people, I mean, the marriage referendum passed in May. And what I find really interesting sense is that, you know, it seems to me that a playbook has kind of developed about how that campaign worked.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I mean, how, like, you know, there's been the book by kind of Gráinne Healy.
Yeah, it was Whelan, excellent, yeah.
It's excellent book, excellent read. And it's like, you know, you read the book and you're kind of going like, I remember reading the book and just thinking like, this is, like the review said, I think Dermot Ferrer reviewed, was it Dermot Ferrer reviewed in the Irish Times? Colm Tobin reviewed in the Irish Times. He's going, I mean, this is a handbook. This is how you win a campaign. And
yeah.
I'm curious about it in another way, because, I mean, like, you know, we've got the two people here that we want to talk about. You know, and like the changing point for me during the whole referendum campaign, there was two. There was a column, first of all, that Owen McDermott did in the Irish Times. Owen McDermott from the Communications Committee did in the Irish Times about tone, language and connections. And fairly shortly afterwards, Jack Gibson's interview with Anne Connolly appeared in Totally Dublin.
Yeah.
And those pieces resonated with me as a political nerd, just in terms of how campaigns work. Yeah. And I'm curious about, like, your view now, looking back at that campaign, what lessons would you kind of pass on to repeal the eighth campaigners and what was learned there, especially regarding tone, language and winning people over?
Yeah,
or
I think
it going to be a totally different thing because a totally different set of emotions?
I think they are... I see the logic of people talking about the repeal the eighth campaign in the context of the marriage equality campaign. They are two completely different animals. I think what was very... I mean, what was interesting about the, and I said it to Gráinne Healy, I think the day of the count, Gráinne Healy, who was one of the co-directors of the Yes Quality campaign, I just said to her, do you know what was amazing about this campaign? There wasn't one fuck up. And what I mean by that is during an election campaign or a referendum campaign, at some point, the side who is winning does some screw up. Someone goes on radio and says something mad, or there's some controversy, or someone element of someone's personal life gets embroiled in it, and you know, something blows up. That didn't happen with the Yes Equality team. And the reason that it didn't, I think, is because it was a genuine grassroots movement. And just before I talk about the repeal the 8th thing, one of the things that really annoyed me during the referendum campaign was the traditional media coverage. And all of the political reporters and news reporters who were making bullshit stories and articles going, oh, no could win, you know, it's really close, or they didn't understand what was happening on the ground.
Yeah, but isn't that down to, like, I mean, a kind of a fault in terms of, like, I mean, how political journalism is enacted worldwide? I find that all the time. It's like they're in a bubble, they're in a Leinster House bubble, and it's all about, like, I mean, elections, and, like, at the moment, like, I've just stopped reading political correspondence, because the narrative that they're talking about says nothing to me about what I see in the ground. The same with
the narrative.
Yeah,
I mean, I think there is a proximity issue, like how close you know, political journalists are to politicians and to the political system and the establishment. I think another issue in the referendum campaign was because of the rules of balance being misinterpreted. Media actually missed a lot of the stories that were happening. So a lot of grassroots stuff was happening and people getting together and people power and doing all these different things, and it wasn't being reported on. And because it wasn't being reported on, that, you know, one guy from Mullagh who I met in Cavan had gone home, decided to canvass every single house before the referendum, or that, you know, like Conor McGregor and all of his teammates were supporting marriage equality or whatever the hell it was, that stuff wasn't being reported on. It wasn't being reflected in the traditional media. So there was a disconnect between the reality on the ground and what people were reading. If you were reading the newspapers, you were thinking that it was close. I never doubted, in the last month or so, I didn't doubt it one bit that it was going to pass. Because when you were turning up to Rialto in a pissing rain on a Tuesday evening and there were 70 people there canvassing, that shit was not going to lose.
But also, aside from the number of canvassers, I mean, the thing I heard from canvassers time and time again was the reaction on the doorstep.
Yeah,
like, the reaction from people on the doorstep. And that's when you knew it was changed.
Yeah, and I mean, it was very difficult. I mean, most of the people that I knew, a lot of straight people canvassing, were gay. And I think, you know, Ireland owes a huge debt to LGBT people who went out there and canvassed, because I'll tell you what, it was fucking hard. And it was amazingly life-affirming and heart-swelling and all that, but it was hard and we did it, we let it, you know? And the other thing is, as well, as that I want to say, is that in terms of that kind of the reaction and stuff, like, gay people absorbed a lot of the negativity as well, which we, you know, like, also need to be given credit for too, because it's very difficult. I know this has been said so many times about having your life debated and your existence debated, but that was extraordinarily difficult. And in terms of the reaction stuff, like, I remember standing at Crow Park. It was actually the day before the column I wrote about having cancer was out in the Irish Times. And Sarah, my girlfriend, had come up with a new line when we were handing out the flyers saying, I'm asking you to vote for my equality. As opposed to, would you vote? Yeah, because then it's like, if someone says no, it's like the personal is so, you know, affronted.
But people did say no.
People did say no. And one guy came up to me. I was outside that pub in that corner. Would you go down to the Hogan Stand? I can't remember the name of it.
McGill's,
yes, exactly. And he said to me, I hand him a thing, and he was like, no, I'm not voting for you, la la la. And it was a dub, which annoyed me as well, because I'm from Dublin. And I said, why? And he was like, well, I'm a Republican, blah, blah. And I was like, well, I'm a Republican. Do you not think, you know, going through the thing? And he was like, you should be married to dogs. And I stood there, and I am not a crier. And I burst into tears crying, and I felt like I couldn't do it anymore,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And there were two guys drinking outside the pub, and they were so shocked. And they were like, you know, don't worry, there's a lot of support for you guys out there. And the lounge girl came out and just said, you can't legislate for arseholes.
But I think I think it's very important to note in hindsight that, like, you know, a lot of us straight people did not realize how hard it would be for you to tell your story.
Yeah.
Like, I think that was something that I remember at the start, behind, like, well, this is going to be easy. You know, simply gay people come out and tell their story. Mm. It's really, really hard to do.
Yeah, and I think that for myself personally, I find that really difficult because I don't like exposing myself or whatever. And also, like, my family and stuff as well. Like, I mean, I had a really hard time coming out. You know, my parents had a hard time with it, and they were having their daughter talked about and their daughter have to go through that kind of stuff as well. And I got, you know, getting loads of hate mail. And but then, you know, you just have to get past that and focus on the positives, you know, and how amazing it was and how it will always remain for me and my friends and my acquaintances and all of us and everybody standing in this room who went out and canvassed, something that we know, you know, and we know the magic of that, and we know the power of that, and we know how amazing that was. And it's like this, you know, bond. It's like this, you know, bond between everybody who was part of that campaign. I mean, I will say in terms of how, you know, the positivity of it and the telling of the stories and all that, going back to the repeal the Eighth movement, one of the few correlations that you can really make between how a campaign could look like in terms of Repeal the Eighth is the focus on personal experiences. That's something that we've seen already with, you know, Tara Flynn and Roisin Ingalls, amazing woman on Pat Kenny the other day. This woman, Vanessa, talking about how she went to get an abortion in the UK after she'd been raped. And talking about those personal experiences, and that the entire tone of the Yes Equality campaign about having conversations is something that can be transferred, because you can argue and deny and make up facts and figures about, you know, legislation and studies and all that kind of stuff. You cannot deny people their experiences, and that is the most powerful thing that people can do in social movements. It's also the hardest and most exposing thing that you can do. It's a big ask to you know, say to people, you know, whether you're gay, you know, you're gay, tell your story so that people can, like, you know, be so kind as to come around to you, you know? You know, or you've had an abortion, tell your story so people will understand. Like, that's a really big ask. Mm. But, you know, social progress and equality is not made on light asks. It's made on very, very big asks. And the good thing is that once you've actually stood up and told your story and been as honest as you can, when you're victorious, you can, you know, Netflix and chill, that shit, you know.
do you think Ireland is ready to repeal the Eighth?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't understand why they're... I do understand why there is a debate as to we're not. I mean, every single opinion poll, every single conversation, every single, the surveying that's been done says that people want the 8th repealed. I mean, during the ploughing championships, there was a really good series of polling in the Irish Examiner that week. The vast majority of rural farmers, want the 8th Amendment to be progress to be made on that. The problem is a lack of political leadership. I've actually written my column about this in the Irish Times tomorrow. You can pick it up to Europe. But about how it's funny that, activists and campaigners have learned lessons from the Yes Equality campaign. So have politicians. I mean, if you look at what Enda Kenny is doing now with his Citizens' Assembly, proposing that abortion is debated in a Citizens' Assembly, and then, we could have a referendum within 6 months. I mean, it's classic kicking into touch. It's to say, marriage equality was put in the Constitutional Convention for people to debate marriage equality so that there would be an inevitable result of saying we should have a referendum on marriage equality. So politicians can say the Constitutional Convention told us to do it. And it allows them to not take political leadership. The exact same thing is being happened now with abortion. Oh, we need more debate. Really? I think we've been debating this for a long time. Now, in fairness to the Constitutional Convention, which was a great setup, and I'm a fan of the Constitutional Convention, marriage equality was a new enough concept nationally and globally and did need to be debated and did need to be teased out. Abortion is not a new issue. We've been talking about it for long enough and there needs to be political leadership on it. You already have Fine Gael pivoting into a space where they're saying they're pro-life. You have Leo Varadkar on the radio, as Minister for Health, saying that he is pro-life. And what will we replace the 8th Amendment with? We will replace the 8th Amendment with nothing apart from free, safe and legal abortion, in my opinion, that needs to be done. And I absolutely... I have absolute, total respect for people who are anti-choice or pro-life as their personal opinion and personal position. That is absolutely fine. The good thing about being pro-choice is that choice encompasses all of those diversity of opinions. It also means, choosing to do your own body what you want to do with, and I think that, there needs to, one of the things that, we need this kind of thing of, we need to avoid this horrible debate that's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. No, we can't. We can't avoid that. It's inevitable. Did the Constitutional Convention suggesting marriage equality as a referendum avoid a horrible debate on marriage equality? No, it didn't. We have to go through it. It's going to be difficult. But, when things are hard, there can often be things very fruitful at the end of it. And I really think that people need to be very mindful of who they're voting for in the next election if they support bodily autonomy and reproductive rights for women. I think they need to be very, very, mindful of that, because if you're looking at a situation where Fianna Fáil said that they're absolutely against repealing the 8th, and if you look at Fine Gael, now essentially say, oh, we'll have a free vote, but you have people pivoting into a space saying, oh, no, we are pro-life now that we're talking about this. I am against, a so-called abortion on demand, which is a meaningless term. And I think that we need to be very careful of that, and people need to ask on the doors, what is your position on the 8th Amendment?
Okay, last question, and thank you very much for your time. Last question.
That was a total rant, sorry.
No, it's good. It is ranter after all. You said it yourself, Una, many times. Last question. What question should I have asked you? Come on, Thelma.
I don't know. What question do you think you should have asked me?
I don't know. I think I asked all the questions I could think of.
I don't know. I tell you what, I'm just really happy to be here because... Now, I mean that in the, most morbid way possible. No, but I just am, and I went down to the beach this morning on Sleighhead, one of my favourite places in the world. This is my 10th Other Voices, and I come down every year. It's my happy place. And looking out at the sea this morning, I was just so happy because I didn't know if I would see that vista again. And I think that we should all appreciate, you know, being here with our friends and having a great weekend. And in some ways, it's good to be ranter and all that kind of stuff. But it's also better to just appreciate things in the moment and, you know, just have a ball, because you never know what the universe is going to throw at you.
Excellent. Umlali, thank you very, very much.
Thanks a million to Una for her time, honesty and generosity. This was recorded by Andy Wilson, produced by Banter podcast producer Tanya White, and made with the help of Molly King and all her other voices. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to at Banter. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.